You may be planning some smooth moves for Valentine's Day with flowers or candy. Meanwhile, the chickadee outside your window is working up a full-blown musical performance for his sweetheart. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and as the days grow longer, wild critters start feeling the urge to pass their genes along. We'll talk about mating season and the strategies different creatures use for attracting a mate, the staking out of territories, and, yes, the giving of gifts, including flowers and chocolate. The ancient rites of spring, today on Talk of Iowa. You're welcome to join the love fest and the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Love is in the air today, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Charity. Hi, Charity.
Channeling your inner Barry White there. That's very nice. Well, of course, spring is the time for baby animals, and if spring is time for baby animals, that means that the parents of those baby animals must be thinking ahead.
That's right. They always think ahead, and it is hard to believe with the kind of temperatures that we're just announced there, right around zero or below, that anything is thinking about procreating very soon at all. But this morning, as I was hauling wood in for our wood stove, the cardinal was out there going, singing away, the male cardinal saying, "Hey, it's cold, but, you know, I'm hot." So it certainly seems weird, but it proves that they don't just respond to the weather. What they respond to is the day length, the photo period. And, you know, back the shortest day of the year was back December 21st and winter solstice. And since that time, the days have gotten longer and longer. It seemed imperceptible at first, but now, if you really think about when the sun is setting and when it's rising in the morning, it's a longer day, and critters can at least physiologically respond to that day length, and we're already seeing it with cardinals. The chickadees, I didn't hear them this morning, but the male chickadees, it's not the normal chickadee-dee-dee, you know, a song that you usually hear. In fact, a lot of people don't associate this with chickadees, but the males go, they say, well, that's a phoebe. No, phoebes are flycatchers, and they don't get here until it's plenty warm out, until it's summer, practically. But the male chickadees are out there. I didn't hear them this morning, but they probably will later today be singing that song. So they're staking out their territory, saying, "Hey, baby, here I am." You know?
So they do respond to day length. Do they also respond to temperature, though?
Some things respond more to temperature than others. For example, last week, I guess it was, we had Groundhog Day. And in fact, I received some questions from people saying, you know, gee, are they responding because it's warmer? And to some extent, but more, it's more day length than anything. But certainly, if it's really nasty cold out, the males don't come out of their dens to check out where the females are and making sure that they're okay on really cold days like today, as they would when it was a little bit warmer last week.
Well, I'm wondering if there's an unseasonable thaw. You know, we'll have sometimes very warm periods in January.
Yeah.
Does that throw some critters off and make them think, oh, we better get busy right now?
Well, no, it doesn't throw them off in the sense that usually those January thaws are really critical for lots of critters. A lot of things that don't hibernate but actually sleep for long periods, things like raccoons and skunks, those aren't hibernators. Chipmunks are another one. They're not true hibernators, but in fact, during those warm spells, they do get up and feed and make sure their bedding has enough insulation around them, and supplement that to pull down a few more leaves or grasses or whatever. So those warm periods are important for that, but they don't seem to throw off their physiological beings. So they don't start into breeding condition as they are starting right now. You're seeing in male chickadees and cardinals and a few other overwintering birds, their sexual organs are beginning to, their gonads are beginning to swell a little bit, and not to the point where they'll do them any good yet, but they are beginning to respond to that day length.
Let's talk about birds for a little while, because birds have such an unusual mating ritual. They have to go through so many different steps before they actually have those baby birds in the nest. But you talked about the male chickadees and the male cardinals out there singing, telling the ladies that they're in good shape, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I have great genes. But what else are they doing?
Well, they're certainly setting up a beginning. They're not quite there yet, because you're seeing at your feeders, you're still seeing, I think we had 8 male cardinals out there all feeding together, not right next to each other, but within sight of one another. That will not happen during the breeding season. When they're really territorial, they wouldn't stand for another cardinal to be within sight of them. And what they're doing is they're protecting resources. That's what territory does. It protects the food and water and cover resource that male has available. And it says, I'm not only strong enough to be a good father, but I'm going to be a good family man by having enough resources around me. And there are lots of ways that they do that. And it's not just birds. There's been some recent research in the wolf packs in Yellowstone. And as the wolves have come back to Yellowstone, they've really expanded pretty rapidly. And it used to be we thought that wolves were, that it's only the alpha male and the alpha female that actually breed within a pack. Well, and that has been true for lots and lots of research projects over the years. But the Yellowstone wolves are finding now with abundant food resources, lots and lots of elk, lots of bison. Now they're finding, it seems to be food related, because often those second and third down the line from the alpha and male and female are also having pups. So food becomes, the limiting factor. So the whole idea of territoriality is not just to stake out an area and say, this is mine, put up a fence, but it's protecting those resources that you need to raise the young.
Is it always the males that stake out the territory?
Usually. In birds, it's about 99% of the species it is the male, although females can be very territorial as well. I think lots of our listeners will have experienced the bird hitting their window constantly all day long during the nesting season. And this happens in robins and in cardinals. And it's usually not just the male. It's often, in fact, the female, where a window is right near her nest. She sees her reflection in the window, thinks it's another female robin or cardinal trying to invade her territory, and she'll charge that reflection, hitting the window, not realizing that glass, of course, is a human invention. And to them, if you can see your reflection,
that's another bird.
That's another bird, exactly. And so you can, they constantly hit at that. So they're being territorial as well, but usually it's the males. There's a group of birds that are actually shorebirds called phalaropes, and in those, the coloration is reversed. The males are the drab ones. The females are the showy ones that have all the colors. They do the displaying. They attract the mate. Obviously, they still lay the eggs, but the male does all of the raising of the young. Some people might say, gee, what a role reversal. Yeah, it's not complete role reversal. And in fact, he not only sits on the eggs, but has to, once the eggs are hatched, feed the young and find all the resources for them. And the female goes off with other females and, I don't know, plays phalarope cards or something. I don't know what follow-up cards look like, of course, but yeah, figure of speech.
I'm sure they're very small.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe we romanticize this a little bit, but I think a lot of us think about nest building that birds do as a cooperative experience. Is that usually something that birds do once they find a mate, or is that something that some males do to attract a mate?
Well, it varies with the species, and certainly some males do build a nest. Wrens, for example, will begin to build bring in sticks into this house or any other tree cavity. Male wrens will build it partway, and the female eventually participates in it if she likes it. But they certainly will begin building on their own, as well as singing outside, saying, "Here's the most beautiful house in the area. Come and live with me." And we'll actually use that to attract the female. There are other birds in the tropics, bower birds and lyre birds and others often build nest sites and actually decorate them. Talk about gifts, bower birds will actually decorate them with brightly colored things. They, of course, used to use leaves and berries and things like that, but now today we'll use anything they can find, including bits of baubles of garbage and tin foil and such things as that to decorate their nest and therefore attract the female in.
Well, and we haven't talked about gifts. Do the male birds collect gifts for their suitors?
Oh, there's lots of gift giving out there, I tell you. And in fact, during a little later in the season, they're not just using song, they are using gifts. You can watch birds, pairs of them around your feeders, and that the males will often go down, grab a seed or grab a berry off a bush and present it to the female. And if she's rejecting him, she won't eat it.
Oh.
It's kind of like throwing the box of chocolates back in your face.
Ouch.
You know? and so he goes and finds another berry or something else that she might like. But gift giving is fairly common in bird species.
And I hate to introduce a topic so controversial right before a break, but Jim, do the females only mate with one male?
Well, I tell you, we used to think that. There is monogamy within the breeding season. There is monogamy across several breeding seasons. And that's really what we call so-called life. Things like geese and swans, we say, oh, they mate for life. Well, they mate for several seasons.
A long time.
Yeah, a long time, and tend to maintain that pair bond pretty strongly. But the more DNA studies we're able to do, they're finding increasingly that there's a whole lot more messing around out there than we ever thought there
would be.
All
right, well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We are talking about the ancient rites of spring, mating season today. All the wild critters looking for love out there. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
They say we're young and we don't know. Won't find out till we grow. Well, I don't know. Well, that's true. 'Cause you got me.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about love in the wilderness today. It is mating season, or very nearly so, for many creatures, and that's the subject of our program today.
Beginning to be.
Right.
Beginning to be.
The very,
know,
very
and
start.
And that driving beat of that music right during the break reminds me that not all birds set out that territory by song, although many do, certainly the so-called songbirds. But lots of other birds use, in fact, drumming as well. So if you're going dancing with your sweetie and like those drum beats, there's a reason for that. Ruffed grouse, which are only found in Iowa in the far northeastern corner and not in great numbers anymore. Ruffed grouse, if you go to the North Woods, if you go to Minnesota or northern Wisconsin during the summer, you'll hear this boom, 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 boom. And that's made by the wings of the ruff grouse as they stand on a log usually or a rock or something and flap their wings together in front of them. They'll raise their head up and puff their chest out, and their wings go faster and faster and faster. And it's a really interesting sound because it carries a long way through the woods, and yet it's hard to detect for our ears to detect the direction. But female grouse can hear that, and they figure out how to find the direction. And they'll kind of wander in and watch him from the bushes, saying, "Wow, he's really good." Another one that does it are woodpeckers. I've actually had a couple of people say to me that they're hearing woodpeckers beginning to do their drumming, particularly downy woodpeckers, the little black and white one with the red on the back of the head that will start doing that. Brrr. You know, and they're using their drain pipes or along the side of the house, or if they have a nice cedar siding to the house that has this great hollow sound, they'll peck on that. And it's not just the peck, 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 it's that drumming, that brrr, brrr. And that's a territorial song for song, if you will, drumming, if you will, for woodpeckers. They don't have a song that they attract the mates with, but rather they use that drumming.
You know, it sounds like these male birds are out there working awfully hard at a time when food resources are kind of scarce. Is that a problem for some of these little men?
Well, it certainly is a shift in their resources. They do work awfully hard at it, and I can tell you, being a male, it's tough. You know, it really takes a lot of resources, a lot of energy, and certainly does. Particularly this time of year when they're hard enough to find resources, but certainly it does. Divert some resources, energy resources, to setting out a territory and attracting a mate.
So these males are out there saying, "I have the best genes. You should come be my mate.
That's right.
I'll take care of you. I have this beautiful territory. Listen to how I can sing. Look at the nest I've built," or whatever it is that they're saying. And the females, what do they do?
Well, it depends. Sometimes they respond and sometimes they not. Right now, the females are not even interested. Their internal response is not to respond to that at all right now because it's not time, with a couple of exceptions. There are already on the nest great horned owls. They were actually doing this territorial thing back in December and early January, and they are already sitting on eggs, believe it or not. So great horned owls do respond during very, very cold weather. During the shortest days of the year, they'll lay their eggs. But, you know, it's after the winter solstice, so they're saying, well, let's get this over with now. And if there are sufficient food resources around, and they are certainly food limited, they do develop and are able to lay eggs in January, sit on them, and for about 30 days or so. And in February, anywhere from mid-February to early March, those eggs will hatch. And if you think about it then, that's much more towards spring, and there by the time those young really need lots of food coming in, there's abundant food available. There are lots of rabbits out there, lots of mice, lots of other birds that have come back. Gee whiz, there are abundant resources then available in the springtime, and they've got growing young ready to meet those needs.
It also sounds like their incubation period's a little bit longer than most songbirds.
Correct. Yeah. It's 30, 32 days, something like that. So they're sitting on them for quite a while.
Well, and we talked before the break about the fact that females occasionally respond to more than one male. So does that mean that there are males putting a lot of their resources into raising other males young?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes that happens. In fact, within a given nest, she may have mated with more than one male, not right at the nest site, obviously, but elsewhere.
In a discrete location.
Yes. and local motel. And she will actually hold within her body the sperm from more than one male. And so those eggs, in fact, may be his or maybe somebody else's.
Why is that to her benefit?
Well, when you think about it, she wants, as far as she's concerned, biologically, she wants young to, with her genes in them, to be available for the future. And that's really the point of all of this, is getting those genes out there. And this allows her then to say, okay, I've got some of his genes, but I've got this other one too, and maybe they'll be better. Because it's sort of hedging your bets. It's saying, let's not put all our, if you'll excuse the pun, eggs in one basket here. Let's have a variety of genes available that potentially can respond to the changing environment. It says, I don't know for sure that his genes are going to be perfect for what's coming this summer, but maybe I'll have a variety of genes available. It really is sort of hedging your bets.
Well, let's talk about mammals now. We've talked about birds, and they're the ones that we hear the most, that we see the most this time of year. But what other critters are waking up and starting to think about finding mates?
Not a lot right now, although not a lot here, but certainly in the overwintering grounds, we're seeing critters get ready. In Central America and South America, there are certainly birds that are beginning to fatten up and beginning to think about that long trip back north. And some of those birds actually form pair bonds before they migrate back. It certainly happens with birds in the Gulf right now. A lot of geese are actually forming pair bonds, and some of the ducks, or they'll actually form pair bonds en route. We will see coming this way in March and April. We'll be seeing sandhill cranes coming back, and they add another sort of feature to this pair bonding. They add dance into this as well. I don't know if you were ever attracted to a guy, Charity, by the fact that he could dance, sandhill cranes, and you don't have to answer that.
I often asked people to dance.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of resistance.
yeah, sometimes there is.
I should have looked for a sandhill crane.
That's right, because male sandhill cranes not only they do the head bobbing routine that a lot of birds do to kind of, it's both a threat posture and an attractive posture. You know, it's that sort of tough guy, I think, syndrome. So they do this whole head bobbing, but then they begin to jump up in the air, not fly, but jump up in the air as high as they can and honk kind of at the same time, give off their call at the same time. And the two of them will face one another and do this dance, and it's great fun to try and imitate them out in the middle of the cold, wet prairies in March and April.
Again, that sounds like that's using a lot of resources.
It is. But, you know, when you think about it, investment in of energy and resources in this sort of thing is important, because it does get your genes out there, and that's what it's all about, is making sure that your genes are out there to respond to the environment and have the next generation available.
All right, well, let's project into the future, because if the mammals aren't really waking up yet or getting out there yet,
right.
But we have seen squirrels interact with each other little bit more than they were before. So what's happening in the next few weeks with mammals?
Well, certainly already the squirrels are beginning to chase one another around, and it's not just chasing them from the cob of corn or the food that's available to chase them away. You'll notice the chases become much more up and down a tree, around and around the tree, and that's the males saying, hey, I'm going to chase you around a little bit. It's sort of the squirrel equivalent of pulling the pigtails of the girl in front of you, I guess. it's not terribly genteel, shall I say, but there's some chasing around. And eventually that chasing around later in the month, maybe early in March, and that is somewhat weather dependent. Certainly as it warms, the females become more receptive.
And how long would squirrel gestation be?
Let me remember now. I think it's like 5 weeks maybe, in maybe 6 weeks in squirrels. So they're breeding in February to have young in late March, early April. And again, that's somewhat weather dependent, but that's when the first flush of young is usually in the nest.
We also, in the springtime, we see, or as things warm up, maybe not officially spring, but we start to see a lot of roadkill. We see a lot of critters, especially skunks, out there on the roads. Why do we see that in the spring?
We've actually already seen some out there, and that's because the males are often the first to be out there. And they're checking out. They know where the females have been, and that's where the whole Groundhog Day thing comes from. The males are actually out checking. They do come out if the weather is decent in February to check out where make sure their females have survived the winter and are still okay, and that they'll mark the entrance to that den site with their urine and warning off other male skunks or male woodchucks to say, hey, this one's already taken, and so they'll actually wander around a lot more in the early spring. And if you stop and take a look at that skunk, I know most people won't do that.
Not usually.
But if you take a look, they're often in the springtime, they're male skunks dead on the road because they're out wandering around hunting for those female den sites.
We've talked about how birds are out there looking not just for a mate, but they're looking for a partnership. They're going to have a nest together and have eggs together, and often the males are involved in feeding the young after they hatch. Skunks, are they out there looking for a partner, or are they looking for a one-night stand?
They're looking for several one-night stands, as a matter of fact. They'll usually have many mammals. Mid-sized mammals, things like woodchucks and skunks, have multiple female partners. And often females will have multiple male partners as well within those mammals. There are some, certainly the deer that actually went through this in the fall of the year. They have... They're looking for much... protecting their harem, as it were. So those bucks will try and defend a group of does against a bunch of others. And so breed only with him. That doesn't always happen that way. But so the breeding is done in the fall, and then they'll have the young in the spring. But a lot of the smaller mammals that we're talking about right now, things like skunks and woodchucks will breed with multiple females, but the females may have more than one partner. And depending on whether they were in estrus at the time they were bred or not, those genes may or may not take from a given male. And so, again, they're hedging their bets, saying, well, you know, let's try another one here.
Is it possible for, let's say, a skunk or a groundhog to have, when they have their litter, because they have more than one in the spring, is it possible that different members of that litter would have different fathers?
Yes, it is. It's very possible. In fact, it happens probably more often than not because they've had multiple partners, you bet. And again, it's hedging your bets. When you think about it biologically, it makes a lot of sense. The particular genes of this one may not be good for the best for survival given the current environmental conditions, whereas the genes of this one are. And that biologically makes perfect sense.
It kind of blows a lot of people's romantic pictures of wild creatures.
It certainly does. So.
Which I guess is not really their concern.
That's right. It's really not their concern. So, it's difficult because Sometimes it's not only hedging your bets. There are some species that are using visual clues, just like the red in a cardinal is a clue that, oh, this is a bright red male cardinal and a species. But within insect species, sometimes you get mixed messages. Fireflies, for example, actually different flashes, each species of fireflies, and we have more than one species, have a different pattern of the flashes. And some of the larger species, there have been some fairly recent discoveries that some of the larger species learn how to imitate the females, lay down in the grass and imitate the flash of some smaller males. And the males come down thinking it's one of their own and they get eaten by this other female species. So, wow, you know, talk about mixed messages, you know, giving off the wrong signals.
A really horrible date.
Yeah, it's been a bad day, right?
Well, we're talking about mating season today and wild creatures out there looking for mates, thinking about spring.
Looking for love in all the wrong places sometimes.
If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've seen any strange behavior out there that you have questions about, or if you have a story to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. That number again is 866-780-9100. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we'll continue our conversation about mating season in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we are talking about mating season, which is something that a lot of birds are thinking about right now, and the mammals will start thinking about it shortly. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have any questions about unusual behavior you've seen, you can give us a call, or if you have some stories to share, we'd love to hear them. 866-780-9100. And I also want to mention that I have put up a video of the sandhill crane mating ritual on our Facebook page. So if you go to Facebook and go to Iowa Public Radio, you can see an impressive display there.
It's fun. if you've never been out to sandhill crane grounds in Nebraska during migration, going out during the spring migration is great fun, and you'll see probably 85% of the world's population of sandhill cranes goes through this fairly narrow funnel between Kearney, Nebraska, and Grand Island, and the wetlands around there have the resources. The birds will stop there, sort of replenish the resources before moving on north. And that's when you'll see them out in the fields doing these displays, and you can get out and kind of dance as well, you know, if you get the urge to get out there. But it's great fun.
You're really making me want to hear about your Valentine's Day plans, Jim.
I have a meeting to go to Valentine's Day. But, yeah, we'll probably do some dancing over the weekend. I was going to say that mammals often use, in addition to things like the sounds, the auditory clues that we've been hearing about in birds, the visual clues as well, but they will also use scent or smell. It's the perfume, if you will, to attract the female. And this happens in lots of things, not just mammals, but also in insects. If you've ever in the summertime seen these large female moths, and the, several species do this. The Cecropias moths and others will give off, the females, if you cage them, they give off a pheromone or a perfume, if you will. We can't necessarily detect it, but we're not a male moth. And that is often smelled by male moths of the same species up to 7 or 8 miles away, and it drifts on the wind, and that perfume is a pretty powerful perfume, and they'll come flying that far to try and get their genes out there with that female. Deer, of course, do that in the fall. Antelope will use the glands that are in their legs and around their heads, and they'll actually use urine sometimes as a perfume. Now, I can't imagine that, but, I guess it's a signal of some kind.
Different strokes for different folks.
That's right. That's right.
So Anne is on the line in Anamosa, and we were talking about roadkill and how we see so much more of it in the spring, particularly skunks when they're on the move in the springtime. Anne has a question about that. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I just wondered if there's been any thought given to if natural selection is ever going to have an effect on how many skunks or raccoons or whatever are killed on the road, that eventually all the dumb ones will be killed off and the smarter ones will survive.
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I think is often thought of, and not just in skunks, and certainly in deer, raccoons, that whole thing. You would think that natural selection would, in fact, select for those who are careful about crossing roads. You know? but I think what happens is that intelligence doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it. Either that, or we have to wait a lot longer to see those genetic changes. Right. Yeah. I think it's certainly possible. But on the other hand, the reason they're crossing the road isn't just to get to the other side, particularly in the fall of the year when we're driving and we're during the breeding season for deer, and we see so many deer killed on the roads. We also see a lot of raccoons and skunks and sometimes woodchucks in the springtime, and they're usually males. And the urge to get your genes out there is stronger than the intelligence factor
they aren't thinking with their brains.
That's correct. That's right. They're thinking with their glands and not their brains, and that does happen. So it's hard to imagine that natural selection wouldn't eventually. It might just, though, select for those who don't go near roads, and so you would never see them. But the ones who go near roads continually get, there might be some advantage to being a skunk that ranges a long way, so that his genes get out there more than the one who stays in one area. So,
well, and it also seems like that would be something that is learned as opposed to genetic, because it is not, I mean, there's nothing really natural about roads.
Right.
And mother raccoons teach their babies how to climb. They teach them all kinds of skills. I'm sure mother skunks do the same kind of thing. So what we might see is that there are mothers passing along skills, but the fathers don't have much to do with passing along any skills like that.
Right. Yeah, that may not be genetic at all, but when you think genetically, you have to think differently, and you're right. Some of these skills are not a matter of genetically passed along. But I think you would think that natural selection would eventually have some impact, but what it's selecting for, we're not really sure.
Thank you so much for your call, Anne.
Good question.
Mike is on the line next from Ames. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
What about frogs and fish and all airframes?
Well, frogs and fish, frogs will be using, as soon as the spring comes, they'll be using song to attract females. And they will actually, you know, the different songs of frogs are usually, it's only male frogs that sing. So they'll use song as well. If you might be thinking about that as a Valentine's Day gift, a sing for your honey. Or you might not, you know, it depends on whether it would be attractive or not. But certainly frogs do that. Not in your case. Fish use a combination of things. They use the bright colors to attract, but they also have pheromones that they give off that are detectable by other fish of the same species in the water. We certainly can't detect them, but they use the sense of smell as an attractant as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Mike. And of course,
they
start a little bit later.
Right, yeah, that's going to be certainly not in frozen water right now with ice on top, but a little bit later when the waters warm up, fish are able to move a little faster and a little more readily, and certainly the ice is out.
On the subject of signs of spring, as we start to hear frogs sing and things like that, one of the signs of spring that we've seen historically are robins showing up. And a lot of people have noticed over the last few years, and particularly this last winter, that there have been a lot more robins sticking around than there have been in past years. Why is that, Jim?
Well, you can look at the Christmas bird counts that Audubon Society has done for many, many years now. And in fact, we do seem to have, we've actually had robins around for many years now through the winter. But there seem to be more and more of them that are hanging around. And you say, well, gee whiz, how do they survive the winter? And why are they sticking around more?
Yeah, they're certainly not eating worms.
No. They'd bend their beaks, you know, trying to get it through. Although they do go to areas where there is open water, some springs, some streams, that sort of thing. Actually, some tile lines will run well into the depths of winter, continuing to have free-flowing water. And they can get things out of that. The mud around that is still extant around some of those areas, but they switch their food source. Their primary food source is no longer during the winter months is not worms, but rather it's berries. And where there are a lot of invasive species around, particularly things like honeysuckle and a few other buckthorn and other things like that that have berries that hang on into the winter, they tend to consume those. Now let's think about this. So again, if you think about it genetically, it says we have a few that hang around. Sometimes they survive, sometimes they don't. If they do survive, they're already here when spring comes. And it genetically makes a lot of sense for those then to say, wow, hey, I can winter farther north. I don't have to invest in the resources to migrate all the way far south. I can hang around through the winter, survive, and my genes get out there quicker than those who are migrating in.
So does it change when they mate?
Probably. It means that they're available to mate earlier, and if the females are overwintering with them, they can get a nest up sooner. I don't know of any studies right off the top of my head that I can't think of any that have looked at nesting dates for robins for those who overwinter. It would take a lot of banding. But certainly nesting dates of many species are moving earlier and earlier in the spring as the climate warms.
Robert sent us an email, and he wants to know if it's necessary to clean out birdhouses before the nesting season begins to give our feathered friends a hand.
Yeah, it's a great idea. As a matter of fact, certainly you want to do that with your bluebird houses. You want to clean those out in part because they often overwinter
overwinter mice, and you want the birds to be able to use it. And secondly, though, it certainly cleans out any potential disease-carrying materials that might be in there. So cleaning out, if you can clean out the wren houses and the bluebird houses, is certainly a very good idea. And the same thing with wood duck houses and that. You want to clean those out, put fresh bedding in the bottom, and then they'll use them again.
Kathy's on the line from Cedar Rapids with a concern about mammal promiscuity. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I kind of caught the tail end of your talk, but I'm a labor nurse, and that suddenly occurred to me because of, you know, situations that we run into.
Sure.
Do you run into any kind of sexually transmitted diseases? Do you see that in mammals that, you know, have more than one partner, so to speak?
Wow, that's a great question. You know,
trust the labor nurse to ask that.
Yeah. Oh, what a great question. I'd never thought of that. I'm certain that there are sexually transmitted diseases in wildlife, but what happens in most wildlife species is if it's a serious disease, they don't survive.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And
or maybe the babies don't.
Right, right. So nature has a way of weeding out those that are weak. We tend to, as humans, one of the things that we do, I think, that makes us human is that we've been able to shortcut that and say no. We want to give them a chance for survival, and so we intervene in that. But nature often doesn't do that. Right now, for example, people are seeing squirrels that have a lot of mange on them. Mange is caused by a mite that burrows below
right.
the skin and kills the hair follicles, and so the hair falls out. And those squirrels are this cold snap we're having this week is probably going to weed out, in other words, freeze to death a bunch of the squirrels that have have a lot of mange or have very poor insulation in their houses. And that may seem cruel in a way, but it's nature's way of getting rid of the disease. Because
right.
if the animal
right.
dies that has that disease, then it's not going to be passed on. And I think the same is true with any sexually transmitted or other transmitted disease. The
right.
critter dies.
Okay.
So, great question. Wow.
Thanks a lot for your call, Kathy.
Thank you.
Well, we talked about gift giving among birds, and of course I know of at least one mammal that is very focused on gift giving this time of year, as you drive along and see all of the signs up for sales for flowers and chocolates.
Right,
and
right. Yeah.
Do other mammals engage in gift giving during mating season?
There's not a lot of that in mammals. That is more of a primate issue than it is for
primates are just more romantic,
right?
Than other
perhaps more highly advanced, as it were. and while we certainly have pheromones, we're not necessarily as aware of those. We certainly use song and dance to attract, if it is attractive. But gifts seem to be the way, at least in 21st century society, that males tend to express their love and their desire to mate to females.
Of course, a lot of people consider Valentine's Day to be a trumped-up holiday. But do you think that there's a connection between when Valentine's is and when mating season is for so many other critters?
I think there's definitely a connection. When you think about the kinds of behaviors that the ones we've talked about today in birds and mammals and fish and amphibians, a lot of those things are done by humans as well. And I can't help but think that some of that is certainly a natural biological response to the changing of the seasons. We, just because we now have calendars and can mark the days on them, doesn't mean that we don't biologically also respond to the day length, the changing of the day, just like other species do. I think that's deep in our biology, and we can't help that. So I think a lot of Valentine's Day and the kinds of things that we do are, in fact, biologically based. So they have certainly become enculturated in other ways as well.
So we should go out and find a wonderful berry or a seed to present to
or
our
chocolate, which may also be an aphrodisiac. You know, that's you know, these are all sort of biological responses to get your genes out there. You know.
Oh, Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife.
Happy Valentine's
Day. Yeah, happy Valentine's Day to you as well. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease joins us once a month to talk about wild creatures. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Ryan Garvey. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk to Kitty Weston-Nauer. She's one of the first competitive female BMX racers in the United States. She became paralyzed in an accident, and we'll talk about her path to recovery. This is Talk of Iowa.
I was looking for love in all the wrong places, looking for love in too many faces, searching their eyes, looking for traces of what I'm dreaming of, hoping to find a friend and a lover. I'll bless the day I discover another heart, looking for love.